League of Ireland Late Night in partnership with Rocksure on Off the Ball.
Well, if Daniel Kelly won that header, you clip that and you save that in the Shelbourne folklore.
League of Ireland Late Night, live every Friday from 10 on Twitter Spaces.
Settle in on Off the Ball, brought to you by Guinness 00, proud partner of Croke Park Stadium and proud partner of the GAA.
And you're welcome to another episode of Settle In and Off the Ball. And Settle In is brought to you by Guinness 00, proud partners of Croke Park and the GAA. I'm John Duggan, and we're delighted to welcome Cavan senior footballer Sinead Green into the studio today. How are you, Sinead?
Great. Thanks a million for having me here. It's great.
Yeah, great to see you, Sinead. And the All-Ireland Intermediate and Junior Championships begin on Sunday, June the 1st. And then we have the Senior Championship on Saturday, June the 7th, kicking off, or throwing in, as it were. And Cavan, you're on a bit of a resurgence this year. You won Division 3, you won the Ulster Intermediate, but you've been at the game quite a long time. You've been, what, 14 years as a senior inter-county footballer?
Yeah, I think this is my 13th year.
Right.
So I joined the panel just out of minor when I was 18, and then I played every year. I took 2 years break there, and I'm back now this year.
Very good.
So I suppose we won Intermediate quite early on when I started playing, and we got to the final my first year in 2011, and I went to a replay and we lost it, and then we won it in 2013. I suppose then we were senior for a long number of years and we got relegated 2 years ago. So we're back down Intermediate again. So yeah, it's an exciting time.
I was reading up about 2013. You're playing in Croke Park. I suppose as a youngster, when you're playing Gaelic football as a young person, that's your dream, to play at Croke Park.
Yeah, it was absolutely amazing. To be totally honest with you, I don't know if I fully appreciated it at the time. Like, as I said, I was 18 in 2011. We got to Croke Park. We played in a replay. And then in 2013, we won it. I suppose I probably had a sense of, this is senior level, this is, you play on these big days. And then there was such a massive drop then where we weren't playing on those big days for a long number of years. So I suppose I'm starting to appreciate it again, being back this year. Those days are absolutely massive and you definitely can't take them for granted.
So what do you remember about the day when you won the Intermediate 2013?
Sure, it was just so special. It was absolutely amazing. I suppose what stands out in my head is probably the homecoming we had when we came back to Cavan. The match itself is a little bit of a blur. It's totally different experience playing in Croke Park than it is in any other pitch. There's added noise and all of that it can be hard to hear. But the homecoming, where we stepped across from the border from Meath just into Cavan, was really, really lovely. And then when we got back to Cavan Town as well, it was really special.
What's your club?
Templeport.
Templeport. And you beat Tipperary that day?
Yeah.
And it was Brona Sheridan with a last minute goal. What was going through your head when that was happening?
I don't know. I had full confidence in Brona. She's great and she'd love those high pressure situations. They wouldn't be for me now, but look, it was amazing to get it. I suppose after the disappointment of 2011, it was great to be back in the final and we really did want to push on and win it that year.
So you're a wing back primarily?
Yeah, I actually don't know if I've played anywhere else in all those years.
I've seen the 5 and the 7 on your jersey, but
yeah,
either left or right.
Yeah.
So it's an interesting position because you think of like Tomás O'Shea, for example, in the men's game, or you have defensive responsibilities, but there's also that ability and that, I suppose, that situation where you can maraud forward and see the play in front of you and try and pick some scores. Would that be that your type of game plan?
Yeah, absolutely. I really like it, to be honest. As you said, there is obviously a bit of defending that you need to do, but you've so much more freedom at 5 or 7 than you do maybe in the full back line. You're more tight to staying back and holding your position. So you have more freedom to get up and down the pitch, and I like to try and get a score, help set up scores as well. So yeah, it's nice.
Have you ever played number 6?
Just for club. I've never actually played at county level.
Very good, very good. And is Cavan undergoing a bit of a revival in every way? I mean, the men's team beat Mayo last weekend. You've won Division 3. You've won the Intermediate in Ulster this year. Do you feel like the county's in a bit of a resurgence?
Yeah, well, I think last weekend was a massive weekend for the county. The minor boys as well are through to the first Ulster final for a long time. And then we won the Intermediate Ulster on Sunday. And then I heard after our game that the men had won as well. And then the underage at the ladies' level is always really successful. So it was very positive. It was nice again to be from Cavan. I suppose on the ladies' side of things, it can only but be filtering on to senior level. At underage level, the success some of those girls have had has just been outstanding. There's a number of girls who have joined the senior panel this year and have won A grade at every level the whole way up. And then you've schools football as well, like Loretto were really successful in Cavan, and Ballybor Community School as well this year. So you know, I'm not going to say it's about time it's filtering onto the senior team, but in some ways it kind of is.
It's a county with a rich heritage of Gaelic football. You think back to the polo grounds in the 1940s, and it was the most successful county in the men's sport for years. So Cavan and football have always had a great relationship.
Absolutely, and people of Cavan love Gaelic football. Even when times are tough and aren't going great, there's still always a massive support, and people are always interested to see how the teams are getting on. And, you know, if people move away to Australia or to America, there's still a huge passion for Gaelic football in Cavan and want to see the teams doing well. So, yeah, look, as a player, you want to do the best you can all the time, but I suppose then when there's a crowd at your game as well, it kind of pushes you on and gives you that bit more edge of excitement as well.
How's the game changed over the decade and a bit that you've been playing?
Yeah, well, for me, genuinely, driving into Healy Park and Home on Sunday for the final, I actually thought kind of, whoa, like there's such a more push like on getting attendance at games, and you know, you pull up to the bus, there's a fan zone, there's pictures, there's young girls with flags. The interest levels have skyrocketed. Like there's a genuine buzz about ladies' games and about ladies' finals, which is really, really nice to see as well. I suppose the game itself, the level of professionalism has upped something serious from when I started. You know, most teams, I'd imagine, at senior level are wearing the GPS now, and the stats are looked at, and there'd be video analysis after games and before whoever you're playing next. Nutrition plays a big factor as well. There's psychologists available if you want to talk to them. And genuinely, when I started playing, none of that would have been in place.
You're a PE teacher, and obviously there's the time off you have in the summer as well. So do you find your profession goes well with the sport you love?
Absolutely. I think they probably go hand in hand with each other. Even we finish school at 4 o'clock, do you know, it gives you time to get home and get yourself set for training. I know there's girls there that work in Dublin and they're in the office maybe till 5 or 5:30, and they're literally straight into the car and rushing down the road to make training on time. So thankfully, it kind of suits it in that way. We actually train on a Wednesday, and in school we have a half day on a Wednesday. So it means you've a bit of time to yourself as well before you go out the door to training. And then I suppose as it heats up in the summer months, you know, things kind of up a little bit and the demands, and you've time. You know, as you say, you have time to go to the gym and to get all those bits done and to get your sleep and all of that in. So, yeah, they do. They work well together.
What's the other subject you do?
Science and biology.
Science. Very good. Yeah, the human body. Yeah. And the human body is an interesting place to go, Sinead, because when you were 13, you were diagnosed as having type 1 diabetes. So maybe before we get into the journey of being a sports person with type 1 diabetes, what is type 1 diabetes for any of us who don't exactly know?
Yeah, so I suppose it's an autoimmune condition. Essentially, my pancreas just decided to stop working. So normally, someone who doesn't have type 1 diabetes, when they eat food or are stressed or whatever it is, their blood sugars are maintained because their pancreas releases a hormone called insulin. So it keeps their blood sugars level. And then, of course, because my pancreas doesn't do that, I have to give myself injections of insulin. Some people will use a pump to give themselves insulin, but I inject it myself. So every time before I eat, I would give myself an injection of insulin. And then there's other factors that you might need to take it throughout the day as well.
So when you're a teenager and you're having maybe strange symptoms, what were you experiencing?
Yeah, so I actually do kind of distinctly remember it. I was in first year in secondary school, and the big stark reminder I have is the thirst. It was unbelievable. Like, you can see Diabetes Ireland do campaigns about raising awareness about people to go get tested, and thirst is always there, and it was mad. The amount of water I was drinking, and still this outrageous thirst and the feeling of that. And then, of course, the knock-on of that, you're going to the bathroom more. I'd lost weight, and I suppose fatigue. I was tired as well. It was just after Christmas in first year. And it probably went on for a little while, a number of weeks, before I probably wasn't really mentioning it to anyone that much that that's how I felt. I suppose starting secondary school, it's a big change too. So, you know, you could have put it down a little bit to that. But then it just got to the point I just was sick. I was actually vomiting sick, and Mum brought me to the doctor and they sent me to A&E and they diagnosed me then a little while later.
Was it upsetting? Were you panicked? Because you might not have been sure what was going on.
Yeah. Well, look, Dad's brother, my uncle Jared, is a type 1 diabetic as well. So not that I knew that much about it at the time, but I was aware of that. So I suppose he was a good knowledge to have as well. And initially, when you have questions and that, to kind of ask them. Upset, I don't know. Upon reflection, if I knew really what was involved, I probably would have been. When you're 13 and that, and you're diagnosed with this, you're just kind of, it is what it is type thing. I suppose as the weeks and months went on, then it kind of really kicked in as to what it would involve.
So you're then following this path of injecting yourself every day and regulating your blood sugars. So when you're then start playing intercounty football for Cavan, what would the day-to-day be when you're playing Gaelic football and also trying to regulate your type 1 diabetes?
Yeah, so it's really hard. I do always say that it doesn't stop me doing anything, and it doesn't, but it definitely makes things harder. I suppose, you know, there's a big focus now in intercounty football and carb loading and getting yourself right and getting yourself fixed. But then if I eat more carbohydrates, that is a massive knock-on effect for my blood sugar levels. So it's trying to balance that and it's trying to get that right. I suppose it doesn't change that much. Obviously, before I eat, I need to take insulin. And then it's important for me to try and make sure I don't have any fast-acting insulin on board for training or for matches. So it can stay in your system for about 2 hours. So you kind of want to have eaten and have your insulin and that taken, so it'll be gone from your system so that your sugar levels won't drop when you start to exercise. So I take like a kind of long-acting insulin in the morning and at night. So it kind of is background. So it's just there all the time. And then before I eat, I take the fast-acting insulin, which is what you kind of want to have out of your system before you start to exercise, because you don't want that drop, because that drop means you have to stop exercising and then you have to go and get sugar of some sort. So that can make early morning trainings, that can be tricky, because you'd obviously have to eat beforehand and then you want that to be out of your system. But other than that, look, I suppose anyone who's played at me pays no heed anymore. I just have a little bag on the sideline, and if I feel funny at all, I'll just run over and check my blood sugars. So I have a continuous glucose monitor, which is amazing, what technology can do. So you can wear it on your arm or on your stomach, and it's connected to your phone. So then it gives you your reading, so you don't need to be pricking your finger all the time. There's a distance range on it, though, is the only thing. So it can lose coverage, and it doesn't give you your reading, but you can prick your finger in a matter of seconds and you can sort yourself out.
So can physical activity or playing intercounty football maybe send your blood sugar haywire in a high way and in a low way?
Yeah, absolutely. Sunday just gone, we played the Ulster final and it was 20-something degrees. So ordinarily heat would drop a diabetic's blood sugars. Kind of hot temperatures. So before the game, we were warming up and I was trying to keep an eye on them, and they were kind of dropping a little bit. So I just took a little bit of Lucozade Sport. And then at halftime, they were 19. And like, to put that into context, if you tested your sugars now, they'd probably be about 5.
Oh.
Yeah, so they were really, really high. It's not infrequent for that to happen. There's adrenaline and there's lots of things going on match day, and that would drive them up as well. So look, you take an injection, you take a little bit of insulin, and then by the time the final whistle comes, they should be somewhat back down to normal.
So when you have high blood sugars, you take insulin to break it down. And when you've got low blood sugars, you take a bit of sugar, Haribo gums or Lucozade.
Yeah, absolutely. So the other side of that then is generally players will be trying to take some sort of carbohydrates on board at halftime, like jellies or energy gels or Lucozade. So for me to do that, then I'll have to take more insulin as well. So yeah, it can be a tricky balancing act, but it's very doable.
Look, we're not robots, okay, Sinead? And I'm sure there's been times in your life in your college or whatever, or that, you know, you might not be perfect. So if you're not perfect, when do complications kick in, and how does it feel? How does it affect you when you're not completely on side with dealing with type 1?
Yeah, well, to be honest, I'd say it's next to near impossible to be a perfect type 1 diabetic. I think there's 42 confirmed factors that can affect your blood sugars, like sleep, stress, temperature, exercise. So if anyone can get it 100% right all the time, fair play to them. I suppose in the immediate effect, if your sugars are high, you'll feel really thirsty. If I was playing a game or exercising, your legs, your muscles in your legs might feel kind of tight. But in the immediate effect, you can keep going. It's not too bad. If they were low, you do need to get sugar on board straight away. In terms of, there can be terrible side effects if your blood sugars are high for a sustained period of time. So I suppose every time I go to the diabetic clinic, they do an average blood sugar reading. So it's important to try and get that within a certain range. Just there can be complications and bad ones too that you don't want to get.
Like serious health complications?
Yeah, like there'll be diabetics who've lost limbs or who've lost toes. It can really affect your eyesight, the nerves behind your eyes, the blood vessels behind your eyes. So I'd go for a retina screening once a year as well, and they just kind of keep an eye and keep on track of that.
Is the frustrating thing possibly that we all want to switch off at times, Sinead, and there's the constant monitoring?
It is constant, yeah. I honestly don't really remember life before it, so I feel that's just it. I don't leave the house without both insulin and jellies. They're just in my pocket or in my bag all the time. So if I have a high or a low, I can sort it out. Yeah, there's times where I'd love a day or a week of not having to think about it. But I suppose at the end of the day, it's my body. And if I yes. want it to work right, I just have to do it.
Do the injections hurt?
And sometimes if you inject maybe too close one after another, it can hurt. So that's another thing. I suppose we're told at the clinic it's so important to interchange your injection sites to make sure that doesn't happen.
This week on Diverted, it's the series finale, Argentina Part 2. It's been emotional, but my hitchhiking journey finally comes to an end, and I finally, kind of, come to terms with the fact that I missed out on the Buenos Aires celebrations after the 2022 World Cup.
A lot of people who I haven't seen since the World Cup would just greet you with, "We won the World Cup." Yeah. It's like, instead of hello, you go, "Hey, we won the World Cup."
We'll also be speaking to people in the Welsh regions of Patagonia.
When the Welsh came into Patagonia, it was so important to them to maintain their culture, their language, their religion, and their way of living life.
And we will visit Newell's Old Boys, the club that connects both Maradona and Messi in Rosario.
Bueno, ese equipo, 74, 88, 1988, 90, 91, 92, 2004, 2003. Mm-hmm. Esas son todas las estrellas que tienen.
Diverted. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts. On Off the Ball.
I'm a Tottenham Hotspur fan, and obviously they've had a good week, but one of their big players for the 80s and 90s, a guy called Gary Mabbitt, he was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes when he was 17 and went on to have a full career with Tottenham Hotspur and lifted the FA Cup in 1991. And like, he's still going great guns. Is your advice, your message coming in here today, Sinead, to say that you can have a full life and you can have a full sporting life as a type 1 diabetic?
Absolutely. There's absolutely no reason why you can't. Yes, I'd be lying if I didn't say it will be a little trickier. It'll take a little bit more thinking and managing and planning, but it shouldn't stop you doing anything you want to do, not just in your sport and life, in any aspect of life. There's no reason why I can't, or anyone with type 1 diabetes can't, do what everyone else is doing. As I say, you have to be organised and you have to be planned, but definitely you can do everything.
Do you have any observations around type 2 diabetes? Do you feel that, would you be of the opinion that that's more based on people's lifestyles and maybe their lifestyles not being the best that they could be?
Well, I suppose it sometimes is. There's more research happening now that it's not always the case. It's probably a little bit frustrating, maybe a lack of knowledge out there. People just hear the term diabetes and they sometimes think it's your fault. You know, you maybe didn't exercise, or you didn't eat properly, or you didn't keep an eye on your diet, and as a result, you have this condition. And that bothers me a little bit because they're very different. As I said, type 1 diabetes is an autoimmune condition, so there's absolutely nothing I or anyone with
it's
it
genetic,
could have done. Yeah, it's not always genetic.
Okay.
So again, more research is showing that there's people who have type 1 diabetes and they don't know anyone, and no family members have it. But yeah, in my case, obviously dad's brother had it, so it is genetic on for me. But yeah, it's just, there's any amount of autoimmune conditions and they just happen for whatever reason. But yeah, I suppose, look, there's similarities in terms of blood sugar control, but they're very different at the same time.
But there's a labelling there that can be a bit of frustration
yeah.
in society, you feel.
Yeah, definitely. I know when I was diagnosed at first, I suppose there mightn't have been as much broadcast about diabetes back then as there is now. And I suppose people probably did have a bit of, oh God, you must have had so much sugar, you know, as a child. And
did
I didn't.
Did you feel a bit of judgment coming on?
Yeah, sure, there was a little bit,
yeah.
But you're going to get that.
You are,
going to get that all the time. I don't pay any heed to it. And I think there's much more knowledge about it now that people realise the difference.
And would you be invested in talking to people, giving people advice, young people who might have just been diagnosed? Look, it's okay. It'll be all right. Just follow the rules.
Yeah, and it will. I suppose it's not that I never talked about it, but a couple of years I did do just an article about it for Diabetes Ireland. And you know, people were getting on to me after that. Would you speak to my daughter or to my son? And like, for anyone who's newly diagnosed, it can be so overwhelming, especially if you don't have a family member or don't know someone with it. Like, the change to your life is absolutely massive. And I suppose that the age plays a factor too. Like, I was 13, so while I was still somewhat a child, I was still old enough to realise and to kind of do it myself. as we're like, there's people diagnosed at 1 and 2 years of age, like that's really difficult, and that can be really, really hard for their parents because it's essentially they're in charge of it and they can't see how the child feels. You know, the child's not old enough to tell them. So there's a lot of figuring out and it can be scary. But once people get the hang of it, it is okay.
So advice for anybody that is going through this is, and if they're maybe of a certain age where they do know what's going on, is just to get all the support that they can get.
Yeah, like just ask questions. Yeah. You know, I know everyone will be linked up to a clinic in some of the hospitals. I'm in Cavan General Hospital and there's a diabetic nurse that's been there since I was diagnosed and she's absolutely amazing. I can contact her and ask her any questions that I have at any stage. And I suppose I'd always say to the kids in school, do you know that I have diabetes, and just to let them know. And there's kids in every school across the country with type 1 diabetes, and you can do what you want. Do you know, it's not going to stop you doing anything.
And from a dietary perspective, you're also celiac. So how does being a celiac and a diabetes type 1 can dovetail, as it were?
Yeah, so I sometimes wonder what's worse or what's
right.
better, should I say.
Okay.
I know, it's just, I suppose...
What can you not do when you're a celiac? What can you not eat?
So celiac, so your bread, your pasta, your cereals, your biscuits, your sauces. When you're at home and you're cooking for yourself, it's absolutely perfect. There's gluten-free versions of everything. It just becomes a problem, or can be tricky, maybe when you're eating out. You're putting a lot of trust in the restaurant that they're telling you it's gluten-free, and it is gluten-free. And then just sometimes, depending on where you go on holidays, and what countries you go to, some are very good and have very good knowledge of gluten-free and of celiac, and others not so much. So you can have a piece of chicken and salad for maybe a week solid, depending on where you are.
So if you eat the wrong thing with celiac, is that, once again, is that going to affect you? Are you going to feel off?
Yeah, now, very fortunately, like, again, it's another autoimmune condition, so it is doing damage, and we shouldn't be eating it at all. But if I was to eat a little bit of cross-contamination or that, thankfully, I don't actually feel that sick. I'd be a little bit bloated and have pains in my stomach, but there's definitely celiacs who would be so, so, so unwell and could be bedbound for a number of days. So it is a really serious condition as well.
So celiac, type 1 diabetes, look, you're in a great, I suppose, profession, PE in biology. Like, it's a really healthy profession to be as a teacher in. But do you have to manage their mind with all of this, with all the stuff that you have to deal with, I suppose, every day?
I don't really think about it.
Okay.
To be honest with you, if I sat down and thought about all that was going on and all you had to plan, it probably would be a little bit overwhelming. Mm. People joke that I've traits of OCD, and I suppose that level of organisation and planning probably comes from all of that. You know, making sure you have snacks. Obviously, if your sugars drop, you need to eat. You might be out and about, there might be nothing gluten-free, suitable for you to eat, so you need to have something with you. So it's just a matter of being highly organised, and I probably was always like that anyway. Thankfully, yes, absolutely, for anyone who has both or who has one or the other, or there's lots of other things people have too, and if you did stop and think about it, it is overwhelming. But I'm used to it now at this stage, and as I said, I don't really remember beforehand, so look, it's grand, it's fine.
PE teacher, secondary school, biology as well. How is the space when it comes to young girls or young men, young boys playing sport? Participation rates, is that growing for you? Are you seeing, like, you know, people are really getting involved and being active more, or is it still a real challenge?
You probably have both,
okay,
to be honest. I suppose the age group in secondary school from about 13 to 17, 18 is where you'd see the biggest drop off. I suppose in team sports, it becomes kind of the age where you're a parent, oh, maybe I'm not as good as that person, or, you know, you're going to train all the time and then you're not getting played at the match at the weekend. So the knock-on effect of that, and not just in GAA, across the board, is maybe the young person wants to stop and wants to drop out. I suppose in recent years, there's probably a bigger uptake of actually going to the gym, which is brilliant. People kind of realise, oh, maybe I don't actually enjoy that. I was forced to go to Gaelic football training as a child and I don't actually like it, but I do appreciate the importance of exercise, so I'll join my local gym. So I suppose once they turn 16, you know, they can go to the gym and can exercise that way. It's hit and miss. There's still people who don't exercise at all. But I suppose from when I started teaching, it's probably improved a little bit. There's kind of more focus on being healthy and the importance of exercise, and that probably has a knock-on effect then.
Are there things we can do as a society to make it better?
Well, I suppose being role models for the younger people in your life. You know, if you've kids, like the importance of getting them out and getting them out of the house, going like simple things, going for a walk, going for a little hike or going for a swim in the sea or whatever it is. And, you know, they'll then realise the benefits of it and how you can feel so much better afterwards. So I suppose showing them that it's the way forward and it's what to do.
Ladies Gaelic football, I was at the league launches and one of the kind of the themes that I got out of the interviews I was doing, Sinead, was that players, because they're, like yourself, working so hard on their physical condition now and there's a real much improved professionalism in ladies Gaelic football, that they want to see a bit more physicality in the game. Is that something you would agree with?
Yeah, definitely. And it can be hit and miss too on the referee, depending on what you can and can't do in terms of physicality. But I suppose from when I started playing to now, like every single intercounty player is in the gym and is probably in the gym two or three times a week on top of their field sessions. So they're stronger and they're better conditioned. So they're probably better able to take those tackles. So it would be good. Definitely, I suppose in the past, there was very little contact and maybe that was for, you know, to prevent injuries and whatnot. But definitely, any intercounty team now, the girls are well conditioned, so it will be great to see it for sure.
And the tackle itself, maybe even to change the kind of the way it's interpreted.
Yeah, it's a grey area, do you know, in terms of what some people count as a tackle and yeah, what others don't, and that can be tricky. I suppose you're taking the first couple of minutes of a game to see what does the referee allow as a tackle and not. And I know they're only human too and they're trying their best and it's their interpretation of it. But definitely everyone's conditioned well now and will be well able to deal with a little bit more physicality.
We've seen in Camogie the scores controversy, which is hopefully coming to an end. How is player welfare in ladies Gaelic football compared to when you started with Cavan to now?
There's been a huge change. Massive, really, to be honest. I suppose when I started playing, you just rocked up the training and you played and you didn't think too much about it. Now, like as I mentioned before, do you know, we've a choice of food after training. There's an option to have a take-home meal on a Wednesday night because you're obviously late home if you want for your lunch or dinner on a Thursday evening, which is absolutely huge. I suppose the LGFA have worked so hard at kind of incorporating expenses. It does flag as an issue still, but even like we get nutrition expenses, you know, travel expenses as well. So it's definitely improved massively.
And you've somebody with an app to help you with the blood sugar when you're playing during a game.
Yeah, so the app is on my phone. So I don't, no need to click Anthony, you just hit the side button and you can see your blood sugar straight away. Slightly problematic if I'm too far away. It doesn't
you're in
work.
The opponent's yeah.
So I'm like
20 meter line.
Someone might need to come running around beside me. But no, look, it's grand. And if you're back beside them for a minute or two, it'll pick back up again. So yeah.
Monaghan on the first day of the championship. I mean, I've read about the Cavan Monaghan rivalry in the men's game. Is it tasty in the ladies' game?
Yeah, it definitely is. I suppose we played Monaghan in the Ulster semi-final this year, and it was a really, really tough game. I think they were 11 points up maybe 10 minutes into the game, and they had a super, super start, showing the team that they are, and we were very fortunate to come back. So now, yeah, we have them again in the group stages. So yeah, there's a massive rivalry. I suppose those bordering counties, there's naturally always going to be a rivalry, and it probably definitely is the same in the men. So yeah, it'll be another good competitive affair.
So Cavan, what's the goal now going forward, to get back into senior?
Yeah, definitely. It's very doable. You know, we've shown good form so far this year. In terms of the league, I suppose we were disappointed as a county to be relegated to Division 3. We competed hard in Division 2 for a long number of years and we lost two Division 2 finals, and we felt, you know, if we could get to Division 1, it would have helped us then in championship at senior level to be playing the league at that higher grade. So when we got relegated last year to Division 3, it definitely was a disappointment, but we were very happy that we got straight back up. So we'll be back competing in Division 2 next year. And I suppose then the knock-on effect is that you want to push back up to senior level. As I said, the underage in Cavan Ladies is absolutely outstanding. There's a number of girls have stepped straight onto the senior panel this year and are starting in big, massive positions and showing what they can do. So the talent is definitely within the county. It's just about having it out and showing it on the field now.
Ladies Gaelic football's had the hooter for years. Would you like to see anything that's been in the men's game now come into the ladies' game, like two pointers, for example?
Should that be savage? Yeah, it'd be great. Not that I'd be getting any of them, but it would be super. Like, there's lots of ladies footballers who'll be well able to kick them. We've Lauren McVitie there at centre forward, and she's a great long range shooter. And Aisling Sheridan and Aisling Gilson, and among other girls as well. And, you know, I suppose it'd encourage girls to shoot from a little bit further out, same as with the men's, if that option was there. But the hooter's great. I've always loved the hooter. I know there's a bit of controversy in the men's game about when the hooter goes off and what's allowed after it. But yeah, I love it. I love that you can see the countdown if there's a clock, that you know exactly how long's left, that it's not interpretational. Will there be 2 minutes, 5 minutes, 6 minutes added on, that you can see it exactly. So the hooter we'll keep. And if we could get two pointers, that'd be great as well.
The 3v3 or the 4v3, but that kind of thing?
I don't know about that.
Okay.
I suppose naturally the ladies' game generally isn't that defensive. I know in the men's football it was getting somewhat boring to watch. I suppose Ulster games in particular were very defensive, or were known for being very defensive. I don't think it's such a problem in the ladies' game. I suppose naturally we kind of play more open football. So I think we're okay as we are.
You've had a great run as an association. We had like 40, 50,000 people at Croke Park for finals. What are your ambitions remaining in the game of ladies Gaelic football, Sinead, as you, I suppose, get into the later years of your career with Cavan?
Yeah, look, I'm definitely on the other end of it. You just love to leave Cavan in the best place it can be for what's coming through. Like, obviously, it's everyone who's competing and who's competing next again at intermediate level. It's everyone's goal to be in Croke Park on All-Ireland final day, and it's no different for us. We'd absolutely love to be there. If it doesn't happen this year, you know, hopefully it'll happen soon. Genuinely, Cavan ladies are definitely a senior team. I know we were there for a long number of years and we didn't really push on, but since then, like, the success underage has just been pushing and pushing and pushing. So with all of that, you know, and the more professionalism and all of that together, I do feel for Cavan to succeed, we need to get back up to senior level and to really push on at that.
We've come to the end of this edition of Settle In and Off the Ball. Settle In brought to you by Guinness 0.0, proud partners of Croke Park and the GA. Sinead Green, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for sharing your journey with us, both in terms of life's challenges and the success you've had with that, and also your Gaelic football journey too. So thank you so much for coming in to the Off the Ball studio here.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Settle In on Off the Ball, brought to you by Guinness 0.0, proud partner of Croke Park Stadium and proud partner of the GAA.